That's a great song from philosopher Jimmy Buffett. What if the hokey pokey is really what it's all about? From his album Far Side of the World, I guess you could call it the parrot head multiverse theory, and it's as good an explanation as any. Kind of throws a big wide umbrella over the topics that we're discussing, the nature of reality, the concept of the multiverse. Dr. Simeon Hine, my guest tonight, has done something similar in his new book, Black Swan Ghosts, talking about the connections between UFOs and aliens and remote viewing and crop circles and things of that nature. When we come back, we'll hear more of these stories and how they all fit together, and maybe it really is the hokey pokey. We'll be right back. Simeon, I know that you had mentioned to us, and you say it in the book as well, about training and remote viewing. Is it ongoing? Do you still do it?
Yeah, you know, I put a lot of my classes online so that people can kind of just watch anywhere in the world and do it at their own pace. Occasionally I do live classes, but I found there are a lot of people in all sorts of, you know, areas that wanted to learn it. So I kind of turned it into something that was like an online class.
And yet your institute, you teach something, it's sort of a version of remote viewing or a form. What is that called?
Well, I call it human fusion, and it was just my way, because people always want say, you know, George, what's the impact of RV for my life? How can I use it to help myself in some way? And I thought, really, one way you could use it is to remote view your own future and get ideas of possibilities, you know, for people that are inventors and business people, entrepreneurial sorts of people. So I have a kind of a real strong focus. And that's what I developed, this kind of protocol to see possibilities using RV and other techniques like that, and then kind of act on it and kind of incorporating what you're doing. Yeah.
Have you ever used it to remote view UFO cases, say Roswell or Bentwater, something like that?
Yeah, we did do, when we were just doing the kind of the training classes in the past, I gave people lots of targets like that, and it was often fun to see what they came up with. Even Roger Lear gave us a target once to view in the LA area, some base, what he thought was a base in the Simi Valley area where he lived, you know, and he wanted to see what was going on. It's so interesting to give a viewer one of these targets and it's blind, and they don't, in other words, they don't know what it is, and to get, you know, they start seeing the things that are in the target too. One of the most interesting ones was we were given a picture of Area 51, Hangar S4, by someone who had been in the government. I think she was just really testing us. And I called a viewer in Salt Lake who I knew. She had a good track record. All I said was, I have a target for you. And I hung up the phone. And she reproduced the picture of those hangars. I think you know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I got pretty close to it. I think you probably know who it is.
Lazar. Bob Lazar.
It was Bob Lazar, perhaps John Lear or something. One of the two. It could have been Bob Lazar, but it was the pictures of the hangar with the MiG in front, right? So that was Bob Lazar's picture?
Oh, I see. No, that's John Lear's photograph. Yeah, right.
That's what it is, John Lear, right. So I was stunned when she faxed back her phase three drawing, and there were the hangars with a MiG in front. And she didn't stop there. She went inside. You can give the viewer cues to move inside to the target over it. We even moved back and forth in time. But I wasn't there. She did this target solo. She moved. She saw these hangers. Said, I'm going to move inside and see what's in there. And she found round discs that we couldn't identify whose they were because I wasn't there to monitor it. But she said there were these round discs right inside it. The picture was so good. It was a great session. So, yeah, we do give people targets like that just to see what they get. It's a good
Well, that's pretty amazing. I'd really love to see that sometime. Maybe we can exchange that.
Sure.
I'll send you something as well. Well, one of the chapters in your book deals with one of the most famous remote viewers of all time, one of the most accomplished, Lynn Buchanan, who shared with us some of the stuff that that he told you. I had not heard some of these things before. He had a suppressed memory that came popping out.
He did. Yeah, and just to say, you know, Lynn's just a great remote viewer and a great remote viewing teacher, and I was fortunate to be able to train with him, as you know, many people have. And he was originally hired as a remote influencer. You know, the Soviets had been doing these types of experiments, and they wanted our guys to do it too, I guess. And he was one of them. But he also was later on a good remote viewer and a good remote viewing teacher. And this incident comes I heard him say this at some conferences I had been to. I heard him talk about it. I think he talked about it in the class. And so about a year ago, I said, you know, Lynn, remember that story you told us? Would you mind if I included it in this book? And what this, and he graciously said, yes. What the story is, he had this suppressed memory of having been, while he was moving from one home to another, he had kind of lain down for a second, and that he remembered these beings coming around the front of the house, coming in, taking him onto their craft, and actually showing him how to fly the craft, because he has especially large hands, and there was this control panel that they asked him to try out if he could use it. He said it was like these dots would kind of come, if just to remember as best as I can, these dots would move across, and you had to bring them back with your fingers to the center, and that would keep the craft stable. In any case, Lynn was never sure if this was a real memory or just something that had been implanted. He couldn't really tell. So he had this idea to bring this target into the viewing group at Fort Meade one day, you know, at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he tasked them with this, and they came up with this same panel, which convinced him that it was probably a real memory. But just like in our previous story, it got even better than that, because it somehow got leaked up the chain of command at the DIA that they had viewed this target, and he was asked to come to this facility one day and explain to an interrogator and a scientist more about how this panel worked. He said they really grilled him to find out about what the panel was made of and how it worked, and that really confirmed to him that this was something that he had really experienced. And then it didn't end there, because a year later, he said that a buddy of his had asked him to come into this big hangar where they had aircraft wreckage from a crash. You know, they recreate a crash and try to see what happened, and they bring all the pieces together and reassemble the planes as best they can and how they kind of crash together. And he was brought into this hangar, and all of a sudden he said he looked at the wreckage and he saw the control panel, the same control panel that he remembered in his mind that the DIA interrogator had asked him about, that the group had remote viewed. And he just said, spontaneously, he yelled out, "Hey, that's not a piece of a plane. That's a piece of a UFO." And as he tells it, the guards immediately asked him to leave the facility, which is pretty good confirmation, right? So that's just one story. Now, again, I got to know Lynn from having worked with him, having taken his classes, and it's just kind of one of these stories that came up, and it's so, you know, he had this confirmation that that memory he had was actually something real. So that's Lynn's story.
It's hard to believe that someone with a mind as powerful as his could have a suppressed memory of an alien encounter. I don't know if we can call it abduction or not, but certainly something pretty strange.
Well, you know, again, George, that gets back into what we're saying, social blindness, right? I mean, I'm beginning to believe that a lot of us have had these encounters and we're suppressing the memory just like Lynn did. For many reasons, it's not acceptable in our society yet to talk about this openly. And our own conscious mind, like I had trouble even dealing with remote viewing with that first Cancun target. I couldn't understand how I had done it, but there it was. I think that our minds suppress things that could really shake up our sense of reality. It's just a survival mechanism or something. So maybe a lot of us are more like Lynn than we think. We have these suppressed memories and this doesn't come out for a while.
You mentioned the multiverse as the subtitle of your book, Black Swan Ghosts. I mean, it does serve as a convenient sort of umbrella for a lot of weird topics to be underneath the same heading. You think that the locality issue is how they're all connected, that they are in fact all connected, all these disparate phenomena?
Well, yeah, you know, the multiverse idea, there are different theories of how multiverses work, and the most recent ones that I've come across, called the many interacting worlds theory, actually suggest that what we call quantum mechanics is actually the product of interacting multiverses. It creates a kind of pressure and holds everything together, and at a subatomic level, it looks like quantum mechanics. The authors of that idea actually said that while it's not part of their investigation, you know, human interaction with other worlds can no longer be ruled out. That's in a peer-reviewed physics journal. It can no longer be ruled out. I think it's a very significant statement coming from physicists, because physicists who've studied quantum mechanics have always said, the stuff that you guys are studying, the so-called paranormal, you know, our stuff doesn't explain that. Quantum mechanics can't explain it. It's events that happen. They're too short, just last nanoseconds, and it doesn't percolate up to the macro level. But the multiverse models do, and I'm beginning to wonder whether all of these phenomena, I mean all of them, all what we call paranormal phenomena, are simply manifestations of other multiverses that occasionally bleed through to our own reality. These would still be rare events, but they would happen, and we would call them paranormal because they just seem to pop out of nowhere. In the book, I refer to that Flatland, you know?
Right, yes.
And it was this book written by the satire in the 1880s about Victorian England, but it's about a flat world where they can't accept that they're spheres. And the elites know that there is this sphere land, but they don't want the Flatlanders to know because they think it'll cause social change and social rebellion. So that when people encounter these spheres, you know, they lock them up. And this guy encounters one day, and they finally tell him, we know it's real, but we can't let other people know. I sometimes wonder whether that's the universe we live in, whether we live in a multiverse. And to me, I'm not suggesting people accept this, but to me, it's maybe the simplest way to explain all of this in this one model. It's bleed through from other realities, and this is what we call ghosts, even RV experiences, you know, presentience, and some UFOs perhaps, are just not really extraterrestrial. They could be in a reality next to us, and sometimes it just pops through and we see it in our own reality, and it goes back to where it came from.
Well, it makes you wonder, I mean, is it accidental, incidental, or on purpose? I mean, maybe sometimes it seems like they have a mission that they come over here with things that they need to do into this reality. And it makes me wonder, too, do we pop into their reality sort of out of the blue like a ghost out of the TV screen?
Right. I think that's a good point, because it's quite possible another civilization could have figured out how the mathematics of the multiverse works and actually harnessed it to travel and have intentionally come over here in ways that we can't go back there yet. I mean, of course, it depends who you talk to. Some people believe that we have figured that out, but it could be other beings that can do this more than we can and show up sometimes. They seem to have a lot of intention and a lot of, you know, deliberate action when they come over here to do things. So maybe that's what's going on. It's all speculative at this point, but
sure.
You know, I think it's a lot better than calling people schizophrenic and schizotypal, you know. It's not that these people, they have a mental disorder. The mental disorder is the society as a whole that refuses to accept that these phenomena are, you know, exist and that people are experiencing them. That's social blindness. It's denial, right? It's there, and it's easier to say that there's something wrong with the people that are experiencing this. But it's actually the opposite. If we live in a multiverse, George, those sorts of experiences would be normal.
Well, you mentioned it in the book that there are reports and armchair experts, or maybe they are experts, but who make these mass diagnoses, who decide a sort of a disease that explains away all these incidents.
Yeah, it is so ludicrous, isn't it? I mean, isn't it what Stanton Friedman calls research by proclamation?
Right.
I mean, George, I saw this at the citizen hearing. I actually went to that event, you know, in 2013 at the National Press Club. I thought it was a very well done event. It had, you know, really good idea to present this to, you know, retired congressmen and a senator and just to hold mock hearings for what we really need, you know, to get the information out. But the real thing was the reaction of the media. And I thought it was so insulting to some of these witnesses that these people that were there from the Washington Post and the New York Times would say, well, we went to talk to a psychiatrist about this. And they said it's a type of a schizotypal spectrum disorder. You know, well, I mean, radar doesn't have a schizotypal disorder. The stuff is on ground radar, air radar. They're talking about, in many cases, people that are in, you know, launch control officers for missiles, thermonuclear missiles. Those people are not schizophrenic. They don't let those people do that job. It's such a simplistic, naive way to handle the topic. It's a basically way to avoid it.
One of the stories
it's not a mental disorder. It's not a mental disorder.
One of the stories you tell in the book is about an aerospace engineer who was asked to, in effect, reverse engineer some materials that no one knew what they were.
Right.
Again, that's something physical. It's not imaginary. Can you tell that story?
Exactly. No, it's right. It's physical stuff. He's not the only one. This is the guy I know in this area, and I've met him many times. And he told me this story once that he wouldn't tell me which aerospace company it was, but he had worked for, you know, Ball Aerospace and JPL, and he had numerous degrees. And he said they brought this material in once to his group, and they said something like, "The people who made it went away. We want you to figure out how it works." And he said his whole group looked at it and said, "This is not from our planet. It was a type of nanotechnology, way too advanced." So I said to him, "So you thought it was extraterrestrial?" And he stopped me. He said, "No, I know it was extraterrestrial." I mean, that's how certain he was. And this is, you know, it's a very, someone who knows, really qualified aerospace engineer. So, and he's not the only one. We've heard other engineers talk about this way. It's kind of, the evidence kind of accumulates. So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned also it's not just aliens, ETs, UFOs. You mentioned the example of cold fusion as an indication of the closed-mindedness of science. Explain.
Exactly right. You know, I have talked to hot fusion experts. There's one in particular, Dr. Vittorio Violante, who was at one of these conferences, you know, with the Society for Scientific Explorations in San Francisco a couple of years. He was the invited speaker, but he gave us a whole lecture about cold fusion. About how, even as a hot fusion expert, he knew cold fusion was real. They had done their own tests at their research labs in Italy, and they had found that it wasn't an easy reaction to get going. It could take a couple of days, even a week. You had to have exactly the right type of palladium. The materials had to be imperfect just to the right degree to work. It didn't work with really perfect palladium. It had to be doped, as they say, you know, imperfect, impure. And a lot of labs didn't take the time to get the right type of palladium. They're not patient enough to wait a couple of days for the reaction to get going. But the long and the short of it is that Fleischmann and Pons, the folks, you know, who discovered this at the University of Utah in 89, turned out to be correct. But it's just an example of how resistant the scientific, you know, industrial complex can be to new ideas. They just simply don't want it to change. I don't know whether it's because it changes the gravy train where the money's flowing. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why it happens, but cold fusion, it's a real reaction. It's not necessarily an easy reaction to get going, but if you take the time to do it, it works. And the scientific community wasn't patient enough, and they basically buried it long before they should have, and it turns out to be a real reaction.
Yeah, the ridicule factor in that example was way over the top. I had a guest last year, a colleague of mine, Jeremy Corbell, who was producing a film about an independent scientist, engineer, who had achieved cold fusion. He's having trouble doing it again, but he had done it once and now has a lot of interest from official people and deep pockets people. Jeremy, by the way, was the director of that citizen hearing thing you mentioned.
That's right. That's right.
Handled the editing for it. But he, so there is research going on. There have been breakthroughs. There's, you mentioned, I think, in the book about Bill Gates putting some money into it. Is that true?
Yes. No. He has a breakthrough energy fund. I read about it recently. Bill Gates was at one of the cold fusion conferences in Italy about a year ago or so. We know he's interested in this. It's right on their website for his fund, is to find some of these clean alternative energy sources. And again, this is another type of black swan event that could get us, that we don't see coming. It's quite possible, even as we're talking right now, George, that someone's already developed this and it's working. That hasn't been publicized yet. There are a lot of labs working on this. It's now called the Lenner Low Energy Nuclear Reaction. And there are a lot of different companies that have different versions of this. It's a type of cold fusion.
Well, again, it's not aliens, it's not UFOs, but it could change everything. If once that breakthrough is cemented and it's acknowledged, that changes everything pretty much. We're talking with Dr. Simeon Hine about his new book, Black Swan Ghosts, about our reluctance to accept the facts that are right in front of our eyes. We'll come back and open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments. Elvis Costello takes us into the break. The great Lou Adler produced this record. It was written by Randy California. Spirit performs it. I Got a Line on You from 1968. It's always a good tune to hear. Going into our final segment with my guest, Dr. Simeon Hine, talking about his book, Black Swan Ghosts. Still got some great stories to talk about if we get the time. But when we come back, we're going to jump into the phones and see what's on your mind. Stick around for our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Simeon, we'll go to the phones in a moment. I wanted to make one more comment before we do, and it's a big regards the nature of secrecy. I can recall one of the very first UFO-related programs I ever wrote for television addressed the idea of secrecy and how it's structured, and you do something similar in this new book. In essence, big, horrible things can be kept secret. I know in having right. conversations when I started this stuff, that couldn't be true. UFOs, crashed saucers, aliens, that can't be true. Washington leaks like yep. a sieve, the story would come out. But the fact is, you could have things that are big and true and horrible hiding in plain sight, and it happens all the time. You think about the priests and the sexual abuse that went on for decades with thousands of victims. You think right. about the Holocaust, right. that the Germans were able to keep that stuff from their own people, yep. even.
No, but it's hiding in plain sight. That's a good way to yeah. put it, George. And another example of, obviously, mentioned in the book, child abuse. Before 1965, it wasn't considered to be real. It was happening, but doctors just didn't believe that parents could do that to their kids. And it just takes something to shift before people say, wait a minute, what is really going on? It's going to happen with this topic, too, I'm convinced. But yeah, it's there. And the secrecy, George, one more thing, is it's not just the government or some secret organization doing it to us. Part of us wants to keep it that way too, because we feel comfortable that way. We want our government to keep the secrets from us because we don't want to deal with it ourselves for a variety of reasons, because it's uncomfortable. You know, it's unconscious, but we want them to keep the truth from us. It's going to take us to decide that we just don't want that scenario anymore.
Well, or them, you know. And by them, I don't mean government. It's whoever the visitors are. That's Whitley Strieber wrote a long time ago. You know, they're the true architects of the secrecy.
Yes, it's a number of different sides. George, can I just say one thing before we go to sure. the phones? I had another witness that I encountered recently that was after the book was published. It's a former security guard from Minot Air Force Base, and I encountered him a couple of weeks ago, and he gave me permission to put an interview with him right on the blog, which you've linked to. I think Coast listeners will be interested in it. He was a missile security guard, and he saw a really huge, bright UFO take off near a missile silo in response to an alarm that they had gone out to investigate. And I put the interview up on the blog so people can just click through and see that. I think they'll like it. It's not in the book, but I think people will find it very interesting.
You do have a mention of something similar in the book, that a guy who came forward after he had heard about Robert Salas. Is that right?
A guy that came forward after he heard about Robert Salas.
Yeah, it's somebody who had worked at a missile base up there somewhere. I just didn't know if this is another one or...
Well, that is someone I heard from the citizen hearing. I think you're talking about David
Cadelli. Okay.
And that's, you know, I'm glad you brought that up just really quickly. I mean, there were four of those types of witnesses at the citizen hearing, you know, former launch control officers. And this is another one. And, you know, it's just so he'd never said anything in 30 years. They had told him not to talk about another incident at Minot, but this was in the 1960s. When he went into work one day after seeing reports of UFOs in the news and all the missiles in his particular launch control facility were down, which he said was unheard of. And they told him not to talk about it. He couldn't even mention it to the missile repair crew that came a couple hours later. He had been told not to talk. He didn't even mention to them what had happened. I mean, can you imagine? And then he talked to Salas, Bob Salas, and he presented the information at the citizen hearing. I mean, it's just so amazing. These people are out there, and yet they've been told not to talk, and they don't.
Well, it's amazing that there are still people out there who keep this kind of secret in light of. And there's major news organizations, New York Times, CBS News, 60 Minutes, they don't do stories on this topic, but there's been a heck of a lot of material out there. And to think there are still folks who are holding on to these secrets is amazing.
Yeah, they're out there, and I think we need them to come forward and tell us what they've seen. If we all compare notes, we'll find out that there's something that we can deal with this. We can deal with this collectively. It might be scary individually, but I think collectively we can handle it.
You've talked in general terms about the consequences of secrecy, that it can be harmful to people in general, maybe across a wide spectrum. What about to you? Have there been consequences for your openness about these topics? Any downside to you in academic circles?
You know, I have to say there's no downside, with the exception that it becomes difficult to talk to the general public sometimes, because people that who've listened to Coast for a long time, we're going to be educated about these topics for years, right? A couple decades now. And if you go to the general public that doesn't know about this, they don't know how real this stuff is, and it's a little hard to talk to them. But another way, as I said, there's been no downside to the openness. I just feel like it's a very positive thing to tell the truth and come forward with this. I mean, this is something that we all collectively own. This isn't the property of the military or any secret organization. We're all citizens here of the planet, and this is something that it's a part of who we are. We deserve to find out eventually what is really going on. And I think even if there's perhaps a negative side to it, as some of your guests have suggested recently, that's why we should talk about it. That's how you deal with negative things. You bring it out in the open, you kind of handle it that way.
We'll come back to that, but let's, if we have time, let's take a call west of the Rockies, Jeff in Northern California. Hi, Jeff.
Just a nap. So pleasure to make your acquaintance. I want to say thanks for taking my call, and I personally look forward to hearing a lot of your interviews because they seem to have a lot of meat and potatoes in it.
Well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I would like to speak with Mr. Hine and ask him a question. I have found a Martian base colony in Northern California that spans all the way down to Southern California and down through the Central America area to the top of South America. I found it on Google Earth when I was poking around on it back in the 2015. And I started taking screen snapshots of it, of these Martian water animals that actually are raised pictures coming right up out of the ground that span miles and mountain ranges and just, you know, miles and miles and miles. It spills over into the coast off the Catalina Islands and somewhere off of the San Francisco coast, and it's huge. I turned it into the Office of Strategic Investigation at Edwards Air Force Base Counterintelligence Detachment Number 111 in February of last year. I worked on it for a year before I gave it to them, and they never got back to me. Not one question, not anything. They never told me I couldn't talk about it. I stayed quiet, so I went back and started looking at the stuff, and they started censoring the pictures that I'd given to them on Google Earth. And I'd also been able to link standard NASA photographs of Mars with some of the pictures that were I was finding down in Northern and Southern California and out in the ocean, actually.
Jeff, let me ask you, what is it you said that this base stretches from Northern California down to the tip of South America? I mean, that's a pretty big base. What is it that you're seeing?
Northern arc of South America.
Okay, well, that's still pretty big. What is it that you're seeing from these Google images?
Raised Martian water animal pictures. They're Martian water animals.
How do you know that?
They're animals that are actually made into the mountain ranges. You can see them from different heights. The pictures were designed to be seen from about 83 miles up in space. And then as you drop down toward the surface of the Earth, some of the pictures disappear and other ones pop back up.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, Jeff, why would you say that these images that you're seeing are Martian animals? How do you get to that conclusion?
Well, they all swim in water. They have tails, and they have these water sacks for feet. They don't have regular feet. They're all animals that were, the pictures are all of animals that just swim in water. And I've been able to correlate these pictures with raised ground pictures on Mars taken from NASA photographs, including the Cydonia area.
So you mean they look like remnants of what's on the surface of Mars?
They look exactly like it. They're the same pictures. There's no doubt about it. That's why I turned it into OSI.
Well, and you thought this was a base? Why did you think it's a base? Just because you're seeing the creatures in the water?
Well, they're on the land. And part of the water, like off the Catalina Islands, off the coast of California, Northern and Southern California, as an example, and down into off the coast of Mexico, apparently that was all dry at one time because there's relics down in that area also.
I'll tell you what, Jeff, why don't you send me some of this stuff, email it to me, I'll take a look, and then I'll ask, thank you for calling in, I'll ask Simeon if he wants to comment on any of that, but thanks for calling.
What I'd like to ask him, if you want to pass the question on to him, is if...
No, he's listening, we're here, go ahead.
I'm live, all right. Well, I'd heard that Joe McMoneagle had talked about I read his part of his interview that he said that the Martians were in hibernation when he was doing a remote view, and he was it was on coast to coast, and he was time dated them at a million years ago. So I found this base. I turned it in. I've actually talked to the Pentagon people about it, too. And I tried talking to some of the inspector generals of the Air Force, but they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to talk.
All right. We're running out of time here, so you're going to have to get to it if you got a question.
All right. Yeah. The question is, are there more hibernating Martians that are still at this base here on Earth?
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it. I'm going to let Simeon respond to that. Have you ever done remote viewing of Mars or any of the stuff that I think Ingo Swann and also McMonagle had taken a look at?
Yeah, you know, in the early days at Farsight, we did some remote viewing of Mars and moving even back into the past, face on Mars, different objects of pyramid. It was kind of interesting to see the results. The thing about it is that's the type of target that you can't really, at the end of the session, verify if you are accurate or not. It's kind of an unverifiable target, but it's fun to do just to see what you come up with, knowing that you can't really verify it one way or another. Perhaps with satellite photos or something that this gentleman's referring to, you could get some verification, but without that, it's just basically an interesting session. Part of it is just to develop a vocabulary to describe some of these things because they're so different than what we normally see here.
I was recently slipped a document. In fact, in the last week, it was a once classified document from one of the three-letter agencies about the Martian remote viewing thing. And I think maybe it's been public for a long time, but it goes into great detail. It does not name the viewer, but I guess it sounds like the Joe McMonagle or Ingo Swann.
Right.
And they see these beings a million years ago under the surface of Mars. And I think that, as I recall from the document, the beings actually perceive the remote viewer as being around there or taking a look at them.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's something you can experience occasionally is the beings you're viewing it kind of perceive you. It's quite startling when it happens. I'm not familiar with the particular sessions you're talking about, but I think both Joe and Ingo did type of work at some point.
Well, I'll trade it. I'll send you the document if you send me
sure.
the... okay. There's a story that you tell from a UK police officer that I thought sounded like a really credible guy. Share that with us.
Yeah, that's just a great story, George. Thanks for bringing that up. We went over to Wales one time as part of, you know, we were there for the Crop Circle tour, and we brought the group over. Colin Andrews, you know, the researcher, brought us over. They arranged this, and there was one of these witnesses told this great story, and this is someone who was retired from the British Royal Air Force and a policeman at the time. He said one night his neighbor said, come out, look at this. There's this bright light landing over the golf course about a mile away. They had a telescope set up, and he said, it was so bright you could barely look at it through the telescope. And they said, well, you're the policeman, right, Ken? You go over and see what this thing is. And he goes, I'm not on duty yet. my shift doesn't start for a couple hours. He was relieved because it was so big he didn't want to even go near it. But the next morning, coming back from his police station at 6 a.m. in the morning, he said he was passing by the Agricultural College, and he saw what he could only describe as an 8 to 9 foot tall spaceman in a spacesuit with his arms up. He described it in quite a bit of detail, up against the wall of the building. And he said it was so shocking to see a being that large standing there, especially the night after this craft had been there, that he just kept driving. And went home and, you know, told his wife, and she, you know, kind of laughed at him and said, come on. But then he heard about another case that had happened the same night in another part of the UK where someone had encountered another sort of non-ordinary humanoid in the roadside, the Joyce Bowles case. So this is, you know, a guy's a policeman, former Air Force guy, and he sees what he described as a spaceman just standing right there after a sighting the night before.
Well, there are a lot of police officer witnesses. There are a lot of pilot witnesses, people who are otherwise considered to be trustworthy and credible. But once they see this, then that credibility and trustworthiness seems to go out the window.
That's right. They don't want to report it. You've talked to pilots, right? And I've talked to them. And even some of the pilot stories I have in Black Swan Ghost, it took maybe a year to get them to give me permission, even once I changed the name to put it in the book. The pilots are that reluctant to let it be known that they've seen these things or talk to other co-pilots who've seen it. It can hurt their career. Look, these things can destroy your career. That's the bottom line. It shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is.
Well, I know pilots who've had paid a price for that. And
you do,
let me ask you this while we're on still talking about remote viewing. You know, you hear these stories about people who are able to essentially vector in UFOs. You go out, you put your mind at mind meld with the universe and call to them, and they show up. Have you ever tried that experiment? Do you find that to be credible, those reports?
It's another thing that I was skeptical of, but I was with one of Stephen Greer's groups when we did this after Laramie Rocky Mountain UFO conference, you know, about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And there was a conference there, I think Leo Sprinkle had organized it in Laramie, Wyoming. And we got together and did a kind of a visualization exercise to kind of call in these craft. Keep in mind, I was skeptical of all this. 80 people, I thought, sure, 80 people are going to go out and see a UFO. It was the first time I had done that with Steve Greer. We went out after dark. It's getting dark, and there was a thunderstorm. It was a place called the McGuire Ranch that had a lot of sightings. And lo and behold, this really bright blue object came over the group, and it got brighter, and all of a sudden a beam of light, what looked to me like a beam of light, kind of came down on the group. It was one of the brightest things I've ever seen in the sky. It was a real object, and it was very bright and very blue, and then it just was gone, just like that. But it was slow and low. I would say it was maybe a mile up, and that I wrote about it in the book. It was, again, one of these things that I was kind of skeptical, but there it happened. And it was quite an extraordinary encounter. I think about half of the group saw it. Half of the group was looking in the other direction, but half the people there saw it. So, you can. I think you can vector them in. It wasn't something that was believed was possible, but there it happened.
You know, I go back and forth on the topic. And, of course, as a journalist, my duty is to tell what you know. You know, I would think that if I got the information that confirms the presence of some kind of intelligence here among us, that it was interacting with us on an ongoing basis, maybe always had been, that I would go ahead and tell the story. But I also play the game of what if. What if you were pulled into a briefing room and shown evidence or projections of what would happen, and the conclusion had been things would collapse, society would go into a funk, that everything we know would change, and at least for a while it would be pretty bad. Could you be convinced to hold off, or to at least try it on a different scale or a different pace, to do it slower?
No, it's a good question, isn't it? There are people like me that are always saying we should have more information, we should have disclosure, whatever, and that you hear the other side that maybe it's simply too much for people to handle right now. I would have to hear that briefing first to really make a decision, but I can tell you that there are stories that I didn't include because the people told me it's too sensitive, and I respected these are all people that have military connections. They had told me stories at one point, and I said, can I put that in the book? And they said, no, it could affect something that's happening now, and I have to respect their wishes not to put.
Well, maybe we'll do that in the next book then. Dr. Simeon Hine, thanks for being here. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks very much, George. Thanks.
All right. The book is called Black Swan Ghosts. Check it out. There's some great stories that we did not touch on. Thanks also to Douglas Preston, author of The Lost City of the Monkey God, my first guest. And thanks to my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, Dan Galante, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, and producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.